Thanks for listening to Star Lores. If you like the show, please consider subscribing and giving a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also help us make more great content by becoming a patron at www.patreon.com. We would also love to hear from you on social media. You can follow Star Lores on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Enjoy the show, and may the Force be with you.
You are listening to the Star Lores Podcast.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Why, you stuck up, half witted, scruffy looking nerf herder!
Well, I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
Welcome aboard the Millennial Falcon. We are in the Circopos system, and I would like to take a moment to acknowledge the traditional space of the Mimbanites, the Kawe, and the Threla. Circopos 5, of course, is what the planet we are mostly going to be talking about, formerly known as Circopos 5, now known as Mimban. Although I'm not entirely sure what the Mimbanites really call themselves. It's a little confusing. I'm not sure what the traditional name of Circopos 5 / Mimban was. It's not entirely clear from the HoloNet, let's say.
Yeah.
Not the internet. We don't have access to the internet aboard the Millennial Falcon. So anyway, we are going to be talking about a great historical document called The Splinter of the Mind's Eye. It is the first, I believe it's the first.
Yeah.
Like 99% sure.
Yep.
The first expanded universe in the Legends canon of Star Wars. It was a novel and also a graphic novel that was written. It really started being written during production of A New Hope. So this is sort of par for the course for what we like to do on Star Lores and getting into all the extra lore that's around the movies. And so Splinter of the Mind's Eye is obviously the very beginning of that sort of concept of our show. So it's a good thing to be talking about. So I read the graphic novel of Splinter of the Mind's Eye a couple months ago, but it definitely did stick with me, both for its historical significance and some of the plot points I thought were super interesting. Some of the characters and the aliens, of course, are Mimbanites and Kawe. I don't think we see the Threla in Splinter of the Mind's Eye. Perhaps they built the temple to Pomojama. It's not entirely clear. I literally just found out about the Threla like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, I read the graphic novel. Jordan read the actual novel. I will have to read it at some point because I do want to I do want to read that and just see how it's different. It's always fun to see how you can tell the same story in different formats and sort of get different things out of it.
Yeah, and also just a few extra meta lore notes too. This book was written as an alternative sequel to A New Hope. I guess the story is Lucas wanted Alan Dean Foster to write this so that he could create perhaps a low budget film should A New Hope or Episode 4 flop in its theatrical release.
God, and so I would love to see the late 70s grindhouse low budget alternative to Star Wars that could have been produced.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
So it was written sort of as an alternative sequel, but the sequel ended up being Empire Strikes Back in Episode 5. But as you'll see as we go through the summary of the story, and also this is your obligatory spoiler alert if you haven't if you have any interest in reading the book or graphic novel. Book was written as sort of an alternative episode 5 in case, you know, the movie flopped. And Alan Dean Foster was sort of, who's the author of the book, he was sort of...
Alan Dean Foster, by the way, on his Wikipedia entry, he's got a nice little cover shot, a headshot, and boy, does he have a great, like, shark tooth or maybe bear tooth earring. That's a very late 70s white science fiction writer dude.
Yeah. And Alan Dean Foster is a pretty prolific sci-fi author in his own right.
Yeah, I did. He's written over 100.
Oh, yeah.
And not only fiction, but nonfiction as well. Like he's.
He is. And he was sort of, Lucas's handpicked guy to write the quote unquote sequel. But it ended up kind of becoming a episode 1.5, you know, kind of in between. The way that it was written, it was easy enough to plot. If you wanted to make it canon, it's easy enough to sort of just plot it in between episodes 4 and 5.
Yeah, they did a fairly good job with like preserving continuity and not backing themselves into any corners particularly. Yeah,
yeah. I actually thought that was like a good thing about the book is well, for one thing, just in terms of tone and style, it did feel like a Star Wars book or a sort of story. And also I kind of liked it because it wasn't this huge grand save the galaxy kind of, it was more of a contained little side quest, if you will.
And that's something I really wanted to say as well. And I would recommend the graphic novel. I haven't read the novel, so I can't say. But I definitely really enjoyed and had fun in sort of a Saturday morning cartoon kind of way with the graphic novel. And I really would recommend it if you can grab it. I'm not sure where Legends Can is even available. I don't know how Marvel's digital distribution works with acquisitions.
Well, I know they still sell all the Legends books, so if you wanted to read the book, it's easy enough to get. I got it at our local library. So.
Right. And libraries are great for Star Lores, by the way. I've put in about 10 requests for our local public library in Calgary to stock Star Wars books that they have. And they've responded to about 3 or 4 of them. And they said that they're going to buy them.
Really? Wow.
So
that's hilarious.
I'm pretty proud that I got the government to spend money on Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly.
So I will, just to give you a better idea of the story we're talking about, I'm going to read the publisher's summary. And hopefully this is also a bit of a get out of jail free card from Darth Mickey that maybe they won't sell us if we plug their, or they won't sue us rather if we plug their stuff for them. So I'm going to read the publisher's summary of the novel here. And you all know my beautiful voice, acting voice. So strap in. As a young but already seasoned fighter pilot, Luke Skywalker expected trouble when he volunteered to accompany Princess Leia on a diplomatic mission to Circopouse 5 to enlist their rebel underground in the battle against the Empire. But the former farm boy from Tatooine hadn't counted on an unscheduled crash landing in the swamplands of Mimban, a landing that destroyed their ships. Nor had he counted on any of the things they would find on that strange planet. First, unknown to anyone, a secret base of Imperial stormtroopers was thriving on Mimban. As if that weren't trouble enough, there was the Kyber Crystal, a mysterious gem that would give the one who possessed it such powers over the Force that he would be all but invincible. In the wrong hands, the crystal could be deadly. So Luke had to find the Kyber crystal and find it fast. Accompanied by R2-D2 and C-3PO, his two faithful droids, Luke and the princess set out for the Temple of Pomojama for a desperate confrontation deep beneath the surface of an alien world with the most fearsome villain in the galaxy. So, one thing I want to say about that is about the spelling of Kyber crystal and what Kyber crystals are. So this is a weird thing that I'm sort of noticing more and more in Star Wars. And also just in general in life is that terms that mean one thing all of a sudden switch and mean like the total opposite or a different thing. Not really sure what to call it, but yeah, that's kind of what we got with the Kyber crystal. Kyber crystal is spelled here K-A-I-B-U-R-R. And this is not the kind of crystal that powers lightsabers, which is spelled K-Y-B-E-R.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't know why they reused that term for the power crystals and lightsabers later in Legends canon. Or why they came up with a synonym for it, essentially.
Yeah.
But a Kyber crystal is like a... it's basically an item you would find in an RPG game that just increases your mana or something, essentially. It just gives you a plus sort of 15 like a, intelligence or something like
it's,
that.
It's sort of, what do you call it? Like the magical totem or something.
It's a buff in RPG terms. Yeah.
Well, no, but it's honestly like a typical Final Fantasy game. Like
that's precisely what I
like
mean.
Like where they have to find like the gemstone, you know, and that they can defeat the big bad with.
And then the big bad is also looking for that gemstone because he needs it to keep oppressing the masses.
Yeah, sort of a very stereotypical plot. So,
but it's a stereotypical plot is... it worked for me as
I didn't hate it.
You say in writing circles, you know, if you ever go to like a writer's feedback group or something, that's what you say rather than like is it worked because you don't want to sort of personalize your opinion. You just want to say this thing worked for me or it didn't work.
Fair enough.
And the sort of obligatory stereotypical bad guy of Darth Vader, who is the best obligatory stereotypical bad guy, I think.
Yeah. That I didn't love what they did with Vader in this, but we'll get to that.
I do want to talk about that and some very interesting how do I say this? Coincidences with this and The Force Awakens.
Oh, okay, with The Force
that
Awakens.
That are very notable
on
a couple of different levels, which I find interesting.
Yeah.
But we'll get to it later. So let's talk a little bit about Alan Dean Foster. So aside from having great chest hair that goes like all the way up his neck and that epic bear tooth
piercing. I wonder if that's still his like profile picture.
God, I hope so. So Alan Dean Foster, as we said, he not only did he write he ghost wrote the first Star Wars novel, like I guess from the Adventures of Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was the novelization of A New Hope.
Yep.
He also, interestingly, wrote the novelization of The Force Awakens, which is interesting, Kathleen Kennedy, if you're listening to this, and I hope you are.
Kathleen Kennedy, who claims that all Disney Wars is completely original and nothing is lifted from
from any of the books
nothing
or
all.
Any of the comics. Yeah. Yet you used the guy who wrote the first Star Wars Expanded Universe book to write basically.
Really the first two Star Wars books he wrote.
And you used him to really write the first Star Wars Disney book.
Yeah, exactly.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
What do you think? Is she lying or does she just not know? Is she just making statements and she really just doesn't know what
We can just give her the benefit of the doubt. I mean, she could just have middle managers who sort of delegate who writes the books and whatnot, like that kind of stuff.
That's sort of generally where I always come down on people being like being terrible, is that they're just incompetent. Like, they're not evil or liars or dishonest. They're just bad at their job.
It's true. Yeah.
And lots of people are bad at their job.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Yeah, for sure. But one note on that. It would be weird because Kathleen Kennedy was with Lucas on the original trilogy. I'm not sure what.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
So
like she was in production.
So she probably knew Alan Dean Foster.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is like.
They probably got drunk together at a LucasArts.
That Alan Dean Foster was writing this novelization. But I don't know. It's neither here nor there. None of us really know the full story. Kathleen Kennedy will continue to claim originality.
This is almost better than my #TheEmpireDidNothingWrong bit with Christian.
Yeah.
Is #, I'm not sure how to distill this point down to a hashtag, but #AllOriginalStarWars, I guess, is just. So if you're a person who likes Twitter or social media, please make note of this and start. Yes. Start hashtagging all of the Star Wars legend stuff that made it into the Disney canon.
That's a good idea.
That would be very funny and gratifying to me. But anyway, Han Solo is absent from this story.
Yeah.
And he's absent for very practical business-like meeting reason is that, what's his face? Harrison Ford. Yeah.
The actor, Harrison,
Harrison
Ford.
Harrison Ford would not sign a 3-movie deal with LucasArts. And so they just didn't write him into this because the film rights for Splinter of the Mind's Eye were also optioned. And so just as a practical reason, they didn't put Han Solo in it. Obviously, he's one of the best Star Wars characters. And his absence is sorely missed in this. I would like some Han Solo wisecracks and blaster slinging in this. And we didn't get any, unfortunately. But we did get a lot of fun action besides.
It almost felt like they had to do a lot of the sort of... They split the comic relief between Leia and Luke, which was a little odd. But in terms of just like character development, you know, where a lot of stuff would have been almost better if Han was there. But I think they mentioned Han one time in the whole novel. So... And it was sort of just an aside, but at least they did acknowledge him that he was a real, you would almost think he wasn't a real person according to this novel, but.
And it's funny how the meta story of Star Wars and the first trilogy and the most recent trilogy, the Disney canon, are sort of, even in the meta story, it rhymes.
Right.
Because not only was, Harrison Ford very not with the idea of doing 3 Star Wars movies at the very beginning, but he was completely against it at the very end.
Right.
And the only reason he, of course, did The Force Awakens was because they agreed to kill his character off
at
the end.
Even though he still came back for Rise of Skywalker.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he did come back for a little bit, didn't he?
They must have had to pay him a fortune to come and do that one scene.
No, I bet they got him to do it during the filming of Force Awakens.
They could have,
And they just lied to him.
Yeah.
That because obviously they're not entire. What the people at Disney says is not entirely true all the time.
Yep.
Anyway, so you mentioned the sort of relationship between Luke Skywalker and Leia.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Anyways, keep going.
Were there a lot of incest vibes?
Well,
it's been a while since I read
only in retrospect, But I'm pretty sure that when this was written, and
they were building some romantic tension.
Yeah. So no, it was like full on sexual tension. Oh, and it was early and often in the book, and it was cringy. Actually, there was way too much of it. there was just like some of it just got a little over the top, you know, and like, you know, and Luke rubbed up against her body and you know, felt the sweet warmth of, you know, it was just like really.
I could see that being worse in the novel than the graphic novel. Yeah,
it was definitely, that was actually probably one of my biggest gripes of the whole book. And it isn't even in retrospect, now that we know that they're siblings, even without them being siblings, it was just like a little heavy handed with the sexual tension.
A little syrupy.
Yeah. It was like, okay, just, we get it. Okay.
Get it. You're into each other.
Yeah. However, it does make it a little weirder. Well, a lot weirder, because I'm assuming that when they wrote this, Luke and Leia were not brother and sister.
I, for the record, 100% believe that George Lucas thought of their brother and sister thing, like on the day of filming the Luke and Darth Vader lightsaber battle.
Yeah. So a little aside, apparently Lucas denies this, but apparently he claims that he had the idea of them being brother and sister early on, even though if you watch Just a New Hope, you wouldn't realize, think that at all.
Absolutely not.
Which actually makes it almost a better twist in the plot.
It would be cool also if you got like a storyline of, you know, Han versus Luke, even though they're on the same side,
yeah,
but they have like this tension against
right.
each other
because yeah.
they're going after the same girl, right?
Yeah.
But when Luke finds out it's his sister, obviously yeah. that tension completely dissolves.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I think it is very apparent in this book that wasn't in the cards at the time, that they were siblings. Just with the way it was written, it was like very clear that it was setting them up to have like some kind of, you know, romantic, if not sexual, relationship. and it was definitely creepy.
Is this episode gonna have to have an explicit title?
No, that's all we'll get into. But that was one of my actually biggest gripes about the book, was it was just like, and again, like I said before, it was just on its own, it was just a little over the top. It was a little too much. Like, Foster didn't need to, you know, go that much into it. It was just eye rolly, you know. It felt like a Harlequin romance at some point. But
and you know why it felt like that is because it's a science fiction writer trying to yeah. write romance.
Yeah, totally.
He's not good at it.
Probably. That's probably the case.
Although I haven't read it, so I can't say.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We want to talk to you.
What was the graphic novel depiction of it?
I thought it was more it was light and fluffy.
Okay.
Is what it felt like to me.
Well,
but that's because you can depict in one frame what might take an entire paragraph
right.
in a novel. So I could yeah. totally see how those same sort of scenarios and scenes of Luke and Leia sort of being flirty with each other
yeah.
would take up a whole page and
yeah.
then be very cringy. And yeah. I totally get that. But in the graphic novel, it seemed like the same level of tension that was there in A New Hope, which was a good level of tension.
Right. Yeah. Well, also that the graphic novel was written years after the original novel was written and after the story of Luke and Leia had already been fleshed out. So I wonder if maybe I'll have to read the graphic novel. They downplayed it a little more in the graphic novel than they would have in the novel, just because of the facts of that we know about those characters.
Right. So about their relationship, one of the most interesting things I found was the scene where Luke full on open hand slaps Leia in the face
mm-hmm.
in front of a bunch of stormtroopers.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
This is also our hashtag the Empire did nothing wrong segment, is the reason Luke Skywalker full on pimp slapped Leia in the face was so that he could blend in with the stormtroopers. So apparently the culture of the Empire was such that Luke, the farm boy from Tatooine, knew that if he beat up a woman in front of a bunch of Imperial officers, they would think he was on their side, and they would be like, good job, dude. Yeah,
that actually is kind of a hilarious scene, if you think about
it. It's a very compelling, I will say. It's like, you don't really see anything like that in Star Wars. I mean, you do sort of see Leia being put in like a sexualized, demeaned position, of course, with Jabba the Hutt and stuff. But you certainly don't see anybody anybody from the Rebels messing with Leia directly in that way. And it's really interesting, of course, because she's a princess being just full on slapped in the face by like a filthy farm boy is a very interesting situation to put your character in. So again, I thought that scene really worked and it stuck with me, especially because hashtag the Empire did nothing wrong. But apparently any like random group of stormtrooper in the galaxy, if you slap a woman in front of them, they'll think you're a good guy.
In defense,
the Empire did nothing wrong.
But so in defense of the Empire did nothing wrong. this very much was a backwater world that, at least in the novelization, had sort of developed a culture of its own, separate from the Empire. And the Empire kind of ignored a lot of what was going on Mimban just because it wasn't that important to them. So all the Imperials that were stationed at Mimban didn't really want to be there. They wanted to leave Mimban, and so I think maybe that it's almost like it had become not a rogue state of the Empire, but just like kind of made its own rules and its own culture separate from.
I mean, it's like what happens, and I'm sure if there are anybody in the American military, for example, who are in some like random base outside of Kuwait with like 12 guys,
like Abu Ghraib or something like that.
I don't know. From those,
Google Abu Ghraib.
From those pictures, though, those stormtroopers look like they were having a great time with the thumbs up and the smiles.
That's true. Yeah,
these stormtroopers weren't on Mimban. Weren't having a good time.
There was some like hinting at how the Empire, the representatives of the Empire, behaved on this planet was a little bit of a deviation from what the Empire as a whole expected.
They were just like sloppy.
Yeah, exactly.
Is kind of the thing.
And they were mostly incompetent too. That was like another thing that like a lot of people that were on Mimban, a lot of Imperial officers who were on Mimban were just sort of relegated to Mimban more as a punishment than
was it Commander Grommel or Moff Grommel?
Captain Commander Grommel or something.
Captain Commander.
Yeah. It was weird in the book, like a lot of them had two names to their titles.
Yeah. The ranks of the Imperial hierarchy are like all over the map. Yeah. If you look into it, like it's very confusing. Yeah. We should do an episode someday.
We should, on
all the random like ranks that are referenced once in Legends and never again.
Yeah.
But, anyway, so about Grommel, I want to talk about his character because, again, hashtag the Empire did nothing wrong. Grommel was very fond of torture and well known for this fact. He loved to torture people.
Yeah.
And there's like a very, like, fairly brutal scene of, I think, Luke being tortured, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's Luke tortured. He's got him on, I don't know, some sort of upright stretcher thing with his ankles and wrists and bonds, and he's like, I think he's maybe got an interrogator droid or something doing whatever it does,
or I believe he interrogated Leia in the book.
Maybe I flipped it.
Continue.
Which again is even worse because poor Leia still recovering
I remember Luke being very upset about the fact that Leia was being tortured.
Right.
You know, and obviously because he's head over heels in love with her in this book.
That's right. Yeah.
So
But also, it's good that we get that upsetting torture scene of poor Leia, who's already been abused by one man today, by Luke slapping her in the face. And then she gets strapped to a board and is drilled with crazy space drugs and laser beams.
Yeah.
But not to worry, because the sadistic Captain Commander Grommel gets cut in half, and not Darth Maul cut in half, but cut half down the middle from crown to stern.
Yeah.
Like he, and in the comic, there are three panels in this comic that really stand out to me. One of them is Leia being slapped by Luke, of course. The second one is the Wandrella, which we'll get into a little bit later. And then the third one is Darth Vader slicing Grommel in half. And and the picture has the lightsaber going down to about his sternum level. And so then the rest of his body is, of course, bisected, and sort of the two sides of his skull and body are like flopping out to both sides.
Yeah, it's pretty graphic. Yeah.
It's very graphic for Star Wars.
Yeah.
Especially for Star Wars, because although we get things being cut off and whatnot, you don't really get a lot of gore or anything. Yeah. But this was pretty brutal for Star Wars. How was the Grommel death scene covered in the novel? I'm curious if you remember.
Yeah, very similar. It wasn't that long. I don't remember it being that long. It was very similar, though. Vader was sick of Grommel and his groveling. Because Grommel was a very shameless self-promoter. And
sycophant.
Yeah, and obviously that is going to rub Darth Vader the wrong way, you know? So, and Grommel wanted to get
off. I'm not sure what you could do that doesn't rub Darth Vader the wrong way.
Well, if you get stuff done,
kill a lot of rebels. Yeah. And that's pretty much
Vader,
it.
Like in my mind, Vader doesn't want to hear any excuses or anything about anything. Just get what he tells you to get done and competently. Right. And if you don't, well, you get cut in half.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, he didn't go like across the midline like Obi-Wan did.
Yeah, yeah. he wanted to leave no chance of survival.
He did it the messy way.
Because Vader knows, I mean, from experience.
Right, because of course, Darth Maul survived being cut in half.
Well, even Vader lost like all his... He knows technology can... He wanted to make sure that he was not going to survive that.
Yeah, exactly. Vader might be a pain to work for, but at least he practices what he preaches.
Exactly.
You know, he's very thorough.
If nothing, he's consistent.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which is all you ever want in a boss.
Totally. If like you know what's going to make them mad or what's not going to make them mad, then you can arrange your day to avoid being force choked or cut in half by a laser sword.
Pretty much.
So another thing about the creatures. So there's a couple of interesting creatures, of course. The Yuuzhan make an appearance, or Yuuzhan. I'm not sure what they're called.
I pronounce Yuuzhan. That's kind of how I say it.
And am I wrong? Did they appear in Chalmun's cantina in Tatooine? Was there a Yuuzhan there drinking or something? Or was that a different furry
Not that
friend?
I know of, perhaps. Maybe there was some kind of Easter egg somewhere.
Or was this their first appearance?
As far as I know, this was their first appearance.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So there's a notable Yuuzhan who's liberated by Luke and Leia.
Yeah.
And he sort of fights the bad guys with them, does a lot of butt kicking, lifts stormtroopers over his head, chucks them at other stormtroopers, which is always a fun move.
And so the Yuuzhan are like a very large bipedal beast, I would call them.
How dare you? They are a being, a sentient being.
They are a sentient being, but they go beast mode.
They are horrifying to look at.
They're almost canine like in their depictions.
I would put them somewhere between a yeti and a bear.
Yeah, yeah, sort of bearish like. Two big fangs. Apparently in the Star Wars Essential Guide to Alien Species, they are in there. There's a profile on them. And in-universe Star Wars scientists believe that the Uzem are a distant cousin of the Wookiees. And they are very similar. They're covered in hair. They speak in growls.
I'm gonna argue with with you about that. Very similar on like a biological. They're similar in that they're big and furry, but
and their language. It's like a same type of speaking.
It's similar. Is it?
I don't know if it's
Shirewook.
No, it's not the same language, literally, right. But they speak the same way.
They speak like Chewbacca speaks.
Yeah, basically. Through growls and whatnot.
But in terms of their morphology, and I'm even like looking at their feet, for example, are very canid-like.
Yeah.
These are, I would guess that these, they've got strange like bottom canine thing type teeth that are a little bit like orc teeth. You know, they're
I was thinking it was top teeth, but yeah,
they're almost like tusks. They protrude from their mouth, which I mean that confuses me. But the rest of their musculature, their feet and their hands, to me look closer to canine than primates.
Yeah,
to me they look a lot more like a bear than a human. And Wookiees look very much like human.
Yeah, Wookiees are more ape-like and
Wookiees are like there's an Earth, not Earth, Terra, a Terra species that's long extinct.
Exactly.
Called Gigantopithecus, and that's basically what a Wookiee is.
Yeah,
is a Gigantopithecus. Yeah. It's just a very tall.
Some would call it a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot.
Yeah, a very tall.
Some natives might call it that.
Furry human being.
Yeah. But yeah, like
they've also got like the very large snout and canine type nose.
Yeah, the Uzem are like far more canine, whereas the Wookiees are far more
hominoid.
Hominoid or primate like. But they both had, you know, forested planets that they are from, that, you know, they lived among the trees. So that's a similarity. Obviously the way they speak is a similarity. And also the fact that I'm not sure exactly what Foster was trying to get at, why he didn't just use Wookiees instead of like creating a whole new species. Cause functionally a Wookiee could have done the exact same thing in the plot as a Uzem did, but they're still, I think it's interesting nonetheless, just to add that sort of extra species that is sort of has like these Wookiee like features, but is different in a lot of ways. I would also say a Uzem would probably rip a Wookiee apart. I think
it definitely looks that way.
They are actually much larger in terms of like musculature and girth and
their upper extremities are just absolutely jacked.
Yeah, I mean these guys, they don't look so much like tree climbers. They look like, you know, they you know can move big boulders and stuff on their backs. But they were
interesting. They have like a middle to upper torso that looks very much like a gorilla.
Yeah.
But then their heads their lower bodies are then very much more on that canid type of body plan.
But also similarly to the Wookiees, these Zem were often enslaved by the Imperials as forced labor.
Menial labor, like whatever horrible manual task.
Yeah, exactly. But the problem with the Zem is that they were often disobedient and they were hard to keep in line.
Yeah, I guess.
So it was sort of like always a catch 22. Yeah, they could do a lot of manual labor for you, but they would also like, you know, apart.
You need 100 guards to keep them in line.
Yeah, so then at what point is it actually worth it to actually keep them, right? So, I actually thought it was kind of it's an interesting thing. It kind of adds some texture to the universe to say, oh, there's like a species that is sort of this distant evolutionary cousin of the Wookiees that are in a lot of ways in the same predicament as the Wookiees are as well.
I also wonder as I'm finding more and more about the meta story of Star Wars and how all of these stories were written with George Lucas as sort of the general manager of this gigantic team of creatives and writers and stuff. And this book, like a lot of Legends books, came out of conversations that the writers had with George Lucas where they just like spitballed ideas.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the Uzem were an idea that George maybe had.
Yeah, could have been.
Even like an original, what the Wookiees were originally like.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the Star Wars, the graphic novelization of the original Star Wars script, the way this is going to get very confusing. So Han Solo was originally a big sort of alien furry hominoid creature who obviously
basically Chewbacca.
Later split it into Chewbacca. And so, but that sort of version, what Han Solo was before, is almost a little bit closer to what the Uzem look like. Is more of like super muscular upper body kind of thing.
Right.
But who knows?
Yeah.
But I do wonder if that's the reason why he wrote the Uzem into it, if it was like some other idea that George had for later stories that just never came to be because he had a million ideas.
Yeah. And so also too, just so people know, like the Uzem characters in this book were Hin and Ki. They were a couple of Uzem, and they sort of helped Luke and Leia in their quest to find the Kyber crystal. They eventually end up getting killed by Darth Vader in the end. That's the Uzem.
And what about, let's start with the Mimbanites.
Okay.
It's an interesting name.
Yeah.
Because again, we had that sort of confusion where Mimban / Circopouse 5 was originally colonized by who? I haven't done the research to exactly figure it out.
Yeah.
Maybe the Mimbanites? I don't know. And so, they renamed it Mimban?
So, okay, a little side quest here. The Temple of Pomajima. So Pomajima was a name given to an ancient Dark Jedi by the name of, a lot of people may know this, Naga Sado. Now, I think this was written sort of after the fact of the book. I think Pomajima was just a name that Alan Dean Foster thought up of. But after the fact, they attributed Pomajima to being Naga Sado.
Well, it's so when the Dark Jedi exiles came to Korriban, they had their own sort of theology.
Yeah.
And their pre-Dark Jedi exile force tradition. And in that tradition, they had this god, the left-handed god, I think he was called.
Okay. Yeah.
Called Typhogem.
Okay.
And then when Naga Sado came and cut off Dathker Grouch's head, I just spoiled an episode of the Star Wars. But so when he did that, then the native Sith species then started to call him Typhogem because he was sort of a prophesied figure. And then,
right.
And then at some point, I guess the Sith maybe had a colony on Mimban, like in the distant past before A New Hope and all of that.
Yeah. So that, and this is like the old Republic era.
And then Typhogem became Pomojema because there are idols of Typhogem on Korriban that I believe are this winged god with a tentacular face.
But Naga Sado was given the title of Typhogem?
They believed he was Typhogem, incarnated or whatever.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. Yeah,
and so then they, at some point, maybe like a follower of Naga Sado or something, started a colony on Mimban, and they built the Temple of Pomojema. It's sort of what it looks like.
Yeah.
Again, now we're going to jump out to the meta story that was totally a retcon by, I forget the novelist who did it, but I think it was the guy who wrote the Tales of the Jedi stuff who then incorporated that little bit of lore into the Sith and Korriban's lore.
Yeah.
So hopefully that made sense.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a, I kind of like that. Like, no, insertion.
That is a very artful retcon, because it's not really a retcon.
Yeah, I don't think
because it doesn't erase any established premises.
Yeah,
right. It just builds on existing lore.
Yeah, I don't. With everything that was in the book, that all could have been a possibility.
Yeah,
all,
there's all nothing. Work. There's nothing that's mutually exclusive. Yeah.
And there's clearly they hint at, like, there was clearly an ancient civilization who built sophisticated structures and had a complex society and economy, and had force ability, or they revered people with force ability and lightsabers and whatnot. So they were sort of it was sort of set up to build more lore around, you know, the Temple of Pomajima and the sort of underground cities that were built. So
absolutely. So let's talk about these Mimbanites. So again, hashtag the Empire did nothing wrong. The first picture you see on Wikipedia of a Mimbanite is one who's being made to lick alcohol off a filthy pub floor at Blaster Point by a drunken stormtrooper. Hashtag the Empire did nothing wrong. And of course, he used a word which I assume is very offensive to Mimbanites. He called them a greenie,
yeah.
Which it doesn't take a lot of imagination to imagine similar terms that
somewhat derogatory based on the color of their skin.
That Homo sapiens have come up with in our lovely past.
Also in other expanded universe stuff, Rhodians are also called greenies by the Empire.
Well, that's interesting, because the Mimbanites are kind of fairly Rhodian looking.
Yeah.
They've got a similar insectoid facial profile with like these big bug eyes. Yeah. And of course, they're obviously green skinned.
Yeah.
And they have awesome.
The surface dwellers are green skinned.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And they have awesome hair. I don't know if it's natural. It doesn't look like they have stubble on their scalp.
Yeah.
But they apparently have like awesome punk rock liberty spikes that just grows that way. That's like green and fades into red at the tips. Very stylish. I'm into it.
Yeah.
Also, another of the pictures on Wikipedia, hashtag the Empire did nothing wrong, is a Mimbanite who's wearing like a tattered loincloth and some manacles, and he's like all stooped over and looks very sad because he's been suffering under the boot of imperial oppression for who knows how long.
Yeah. And then the next, you want to get into the Kawe?
Yeah, let's talk about the Kawe. That makes sense.
Yeah.
They've got some awesome black metal corpse paint around their eyes, which I really like.
So the surface dweller, they're basically the same species as the Kawe, but they're green. And then less
hair on their head as well.
Yeah, yeah.
The Wikipedia picture is more of a Chuck Liddell type mohawk than a punk rocker mohawk.
Right. And those who dwell underground, which is more of the aboriginals, are the the red Kawes.
I think they're both aboriginals. Why aren't they both aboriginals?
Well, they are. I guess so, but I guess I'm just thinking in terms of there's...
It looks like really the only difference is their skin color from... Like they are in primatology what you call... They have a gracile body plan. So they have like long, lean limbs. They're just a little bit longer than a human.
Yeah.
Their legs and relatively short, compact, slender torsos.
Yeah.
And sort of average looking human arms.
Yeah. But physiologically, they're pretty much the same as the Kawe. The greenies are. I'm assuming that their skin is just because of their exposure to the sun, and the Kawes have not been exposed to the sun.
It's hard to say when you're talking about green and red. Maybe it has some... This is actually interesting that you bring this up. Maybe it has something to do with the particular radiation that comes from the star of Circapaus.
Because it's not... It's, just to be clear, it's not explained in, as far as I remember, it's not explained in the book why they're a different color, but it does say they're basically the same species, just like there's white and black in our species, right?
And that's what I was going to get to is, and this is an ignorant Sam's take on it, but in humans, basically your skin color, the darker you are, the more melanin you have.
Yeah.
The reason you have melanin is because you need to block out all of the sun that's coming down on you because you live at the equator and you're getting sun constantly. And then less melanin also allows you to synthesize more vitamin D, which you can only get from exposure to the sun.
Right.
And so then as people go further north and have less sunlight for long periods of time, their skin slowly gets whiter. Yeah. And so is there a similar mechanism going on Mimban that's for some reason going to red and green? It is interesting because, of course, stars vary in their color according to their age and their size, right? So we have like a main sequence star that I'm really forgetting my astronomy 1000 class right now. I'm not sure what.
But do you remember your astrology?
I do remember my astrology. Mimbanis are all Tauruses, I think. And Luke,
that's the only time they're born.
Luke's got to be a Pisces, right? Because he's space Jesus.
I guess so. Jesus
was a fisher of man, right?
Yep.
But that's my best on Star Wars astrology. I hope some Legends writer has come up with a Star Wars astrology.
Totally.
So that's you got your greenies, you got your Coways. Basically, it's the Eloy and the Morlocks, right? From The Time Machine by H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
It's true, totally.
I didn't think of that, but
The mean bad guys live underground, and the good guys, who are nice to a fault, perhaps a little bit meek, live above ground.
Yeah. But also what's, I just thought what was interesting, there was a very distinct culture of the Coways underground. That's where they were. They met Luke and Leia and eventually Darth Vader. But the this underground people that, you know, they were pretty primitive.
I don't know if they're more primitive than the Mimbanites, though. Like,
well, at least the surface dwellers had access to like imperial technology, right?
But they're dressed like almost the same, right?
From what I remember, the ones underground were dressed far less.
Because I'm looking at a picture that's got them with skull helmets and rib cage. But then our picture of a Mimbanite, let me find it. Our Mimbanite picture, all he's got is like a little loincloth and some manacles.
I was reading the novelization.
Could just be because he's enslaved by hashtag the Empire.
In my mind, he was just like a poor like surface dweller who, was probably dressed in rags, but maybe not that little. But I don't know. It's hard to conceptualize it.
All the Mimbanites that appear in the graphic novel anyway are basically wearing loincloths and that's it.
Okay. Well, at the very least, the surface dwellers do have access to, and I'm guessing somewhat know how to use imperial technology, and they're also used as slaves too. You got to remember in mining and stuff
And so props to the Kawe who managed, like, I didn't, were there even any reference to like enslaved Kawe? It seems like
they're free people
with chipped stone tools
and
weapons fighting off the Empire successfully.
Yeah. Well, and it was very difficult. So they had like a very complex tunnel system, like basically this crazy underground city that was ancient. And that was one of the things that was able to keep them from being enslaved, because it was more trouble than it was worth to go down there and try and, you know, catch them. Right. But also an interesting point of them is they had like a very distinct culture. And one of the things like Luke, you know,
murdered a couple of them, which is sort of like almost an aside in the book.
It's par for the course for Luke.
So he kills a couple of them, and they like don't even care.
Kills a couple indigenous people here, trains a couple of Sith lords here, there, you know.
Exactly. But their sort of attitude towards death is very much like, well, it was meant to happen, so it happened, right? Like, it's sort of an interesting cult. Like, I just thought it was like kind of an interesting anthropological.
That's a cool take on it, how different societies sort of conceptualize death.
Yeah, exactly.
Was there anything about Mimbanite views on death?
Like the surface dwellers?
Yeah.
Not that I remember.
I wonder if there would be like some shared cultural continuity where they're both sort of generally, those societies believe in determinism.
Yeah, well,
right is what we're talking about.
It was very much like, well, whatever happens is meant to happen, right?
And so maybe the Mimbanites sort of feel the same, that it's like, if we're being enslaved, I guess we're supposed to be enslaved.
It could very much be the case, but it was just sort of, they weren't even angry that Luke killed like a couple of their people. Like it was just sort of, that was sort of supposed to happen. You know, it's just sort of an interesting, a unique cultural view on death, you know, and
we'll get into it on our xenoneurobiology episode. Why a species would not be mad at you for killing a bunch of your buddies.
Totally.
So the final interesting Pokemon in this episode is the one Drella. This is sort of like, you know how in a lot of video games, when you get to the final boss and you beat him and you're like, was that the end of the game? This seems anticlimactic, but then it's like, oh no, there's another final boss after that. So the Wandrella is sort of that. He's your mini boss that you fight before fighting Darth Vader. And so what is the Wandrella?
This isn't a very super unique species in science fiction, but it's
basically, or in Star Wars even, it's used over and over again.
Yeah.
There are like 10 different versions of the Wandrella.
Yeah, it's like a giant worm, basically, that, you know, likes to eat big things and chases Luke and Leia in their vehicle.
Lives in the swamp, by the way, which I have to bring it back around to the beginning. Luke Skywalker crash lands his X-Wing in a swamp. And this is very clearly a scene that directly, I'm not sure if it's, again, one of those ones that George Lucas already had in his head, or if he just straight up was like, that was cool, let's do that in Empire Strikes Back.
Yes.
But literally the exact, it looks like a storyboard from when you read the graphic novel.
Yeah,
from Empire Strikes Back, crashing.
I think it is clear that this is like this, that Mimban was the inspiration for Dagobah.
And there's even, like, Dagobah had an ancient, wizened, maybe crazy ex-Jedi master living on it.
Yeah, so Hala, that's the other character we didn't get into. But yes, just remember, Mimban is like sort of this rainforest jungle world with like lots of swamps and stuff like that. So think Dagobah and then Luke crash lands his
Dagobah with like an imperial presence and a civilization
with a mining colony on it, you know,
which is another thing I wanted to touch on. They're mining, scare quotes, energy.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean?
They didn't really, who knows what they're mining.
Energy. That's what they said they're mining.
Maybe it's coal.
That is literally the most broad thing you could possibly say about what you're mining.
Yeah.
Energy?
Who knows?
Is it like a metaphysical thing? Maybe that's a broad term the Empire uses for natural resources. I got the feeling it was some sort of electromagnetic energy.
It messed up with their, that's part of the reason they crashed, because it messed up with their instruments on their vehicles, on their X-Wings, X-Wing and Y-Wing.
So if there are any physicists listening, what could you possibly find on a random planet that's like a static form of energy, but it's electromagnetic energy? We're not talking about something that you burn to then produce the energy that you need, but it's like a contained, constant electric charge that could possibly be stored. It sounds very not probable. But anyway, it's a very small point. I kind of wish they would have said coal, but...
yeah.
So the Temple of Pomojama, or the Pomojama Temple, where they have their final showdown with Darth Vader, who what? He's looking for the Final Fantasy crystals of earth, air, fire, and water or something? Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, basically. You know, the Kyber crystal, which was the whole quest was began by this character named Hala, who is this sort of... She's actually kind of interesting. She's a force sensitive, can detect the force in other people. She can use the force, but she's not very good at it. Like, she can use it very crudely, if you will.
It kind of seems like she has dementia or something, possibly.
Could be, yeah.
Like, she's very old.
Yeah.
Is she referenced specifically as being a Jedi Master from the past, or is she just...
No.
She's just a Force sensitive.
Yeah, she knows a little bit how to use the Force, you know. But you also got to remember, Luke is in that same boat with her. Yeah. In a lot of ways, they have like the same level of Force ability, because Luke only had just recently used the Force for the first time when he destroyed the Death Star, right? So... And that was almost more of an instinctual thing than like he was using it on purpose. But Hala knows how to use it, but it takes, like, it exhausts her every time she tries to use it. And like, she helped them escape from prison, but it was like very it wasted a lot of her energy. And so it's not like, don't think of like a crazy Jedi master who's very like experienced in using the Force. This is a woman who is familiar with the Force and somehow, some way, it's sort of a mystery how she learned to use it. But she, you know, and she's sort of the guide character in this story as well. Like, she kind of ends up starting the quest for Luke and Leia. But she introduces them to this Kyber crystal.
In our hero's journey nomenclature, yeah. she would be, what's that called? So there's the call to adventure. She would be the herald, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the actual... It's like the guide. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's the Obi-Wan figure.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. Like she says, if you help me find this crystal, I can help you get off the planet because their ships have been destroyed, right? So, and that's sort of how the whole quest begins. And yeah, like you said, it's very Final Fantasy. It's
literally a crystal that you have to find from an ancient temple.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Every Final Fantasy game ever produced.
Basically, yeah. So,
and the temple is filled with traps.
Yeah.
And you have to fight somebody at the very end.
Yeah.
It's interesting too. This is reminding me now, Hala's character... It's really similar, I think, to Vima Dabota, I think is her name.
Yeah.
And she was that, again, sort of that force using, sort of half crazy. Maybe she has dementia or PTSD or something like that.
Yeah.
That makes her a little bit hard to understand.
And, yeah.
But she does have some force talents, clearly. And she can teach a fledgling, in this case, Leia, who's like learning the ropes of being a Jedi during the Dark Empire comic book run.
Right. Yeah.
And Tom Veitch, as I already said, he's the guy who wrote Tales of the Jedi, who also incorporated some of that Pomojama lore into the Sith lore, which then he wrote.
Right.
So now I'm really in love with Tom Veitch because he's like us in that he's sort of absolutely obsessively going through every single detail of the Legends canon.
Yeah.
And I mean, when Tom Veitch was writing Tales of the Jedi, the Legends canon was not nearly as big or as good because Tom Veitch wrote a bunch of the good Legends canon stuff.
Yeah.
But he went through it all with that like fine granularity where he really cared about knowing the whole story and being able to bring and build upon lore that was already existing and not having to claim that he's making it all up for himself and it's all original. He actually goes to the primary sources and basically like a historian documents all this stuff and then brings it out into new stories.
Yeah, for sure.
So the duel, let's talk about the duel between Darth Vader and Princess Leia.
And Luke.
And then Luke at the very end. He puts the nail in the coffin. What does he do? Does he cut off any limbs or anything?
Luke ends up cutting Darth Vader's arm off.
Right.
Which is, you know, sort of prophetic of what...
That's, by the way, by my count, at least the third time Darth Vader has lost that arm.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it is...
Keep your arms together, Anakin. Yeah.
It is said, like, in the book that it's like a cybernetic arm because, like, wires are all attached to it, right? So, obviously, that's in line with the lore of who Darth Vader is supposed to be. And, like, at that point, Lucas had already had the
he's
idea...
He's more machine than man.
Yeah.
Twisted and evil.
Yeah, he's a cybernetic organism, you know, so...
Well, aren't we all?
Sure, fair enough. But Leia also apparently holds her own.
Yes, she does. I wanted to bring this up because, of course, what is one of the biggest criticisms of The Force Awakens?
Right, is people who have way more ability than they should. I'm trying to remember, like,
it's again another plot point that has nothing to do with Legends.
Yeah. So the funny thing is Vader like slices through the two Uzem characters, Hin and Ki, and kills them both. One of them comes and saves Luke, but then kind of dies at the end. But he's injured when he saves Luke because a big piece of rock falls on Luke's leg and he can't escape. And then Leia has to defend them. and then one of the funny things that I thought was almost kind of silly was like, Vader, nicks, Leia's, face with his lightsaber.
Poor Leia's face. Just no love for Leia's face
and her back.
Getting slapped, getting lightsabered.
Yeah.
Poor Leia.
And her back, right? But of course...
Some Bactaid on it. It'll be better.
No. Of course, in the end, like, there's no scarring because the Force and the Kyber crystal are able to heal it entirely. So those scars don't appear, obviously, in Empire Strikes Back. It was a kind of a gripe that... For the most part, Vader was his character, but he should have... Like, in my opinion, Vader should have just made mincemeat of Leia and Luke. It should have just, but the way that Foster was presenting it was he was sort of toying with them and he overestimated his own ability.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Is the first thing is, it's interesting that you're saying that, how this fight was like not as in Vader's favor, especially now in light of all the Legends material, what we know he's capable of doing to people.
Yeah, yeah.
And this young lady who just picks up a lightsaber for the first time in her life manages to like not get cut in half immediately is pretty insane. I wonder if it was foreshadowing, though. This goes back to maybe Lucas did have the idea of them being brother and sister.
Could have been.
Maybe it was foreshadowing her Force sensitivity.
Yeah.
And that was the
reason. She actually had some kind of innate ability.
And it was the Force that allowed her to at least hold her own, or perhaps cause Vader to overestimate his abilities.
Well, the other sort of explanation that I thought of was Vader knows this is his son and daughter.
Does he?
Or at the very least.
Oh, yeah, I guess he does.
Yeah, he would.
Well, he knows Luke is his son.
At the very least, he would know Luke is... No, he'd probably know Leia as his daughter.
Yeah,
I guess he would.
Yeah.
And so he actually doesn't want to kill them, right? And so that would explain why he's sort of toying with them and is more interested in just incapacitating them and then maybe underestimates them a little bit and then, you know, gets too close to the fire. And that's sort of like my... which is to me a reasonable explanation.
No, I think it does actually go with Darth Vader's larger character that's built on in Legends. Is he was constantly trying to train other acolytes that could help him to overthrow Palpatine. Like from word one, Darth Vader was always trying to get rid of Palpatine and have his second revenge.
Yeah.
And he definitely wanted to do that with Luke.
So it does kind of make sense with this character that he probably could have just in 3 seconds killed them both, but he didn't actually want to kill them. He probably wanted the Kyber crystal and wanted them to lead him to it. So that's why he held off from killing them. But also the another thing about the overestimation, I was also thinking, you know, it is... If you think about Anakin in the original trilogy,
he's always doing that.
He's always overestimating his own ability.
His own ability is pretty great.
Oh yeah, he is like very, but his ability isn't refined enough, I guess, in the original trilogy. But like with Count Dooku, he overestimates himself and he, you know, gets his arm chopped off, and then obviously with Obi-Wan, he also overestimates.
And then here for the third time,
for a third time.
He overestimates himself and gets his arm cut off, doesn't he?
He just keeps losing limbs.
Same mistake over and over.
His own limbs.
That's the one bad thing about Darth Vader as a boss, is he just makes the same mistake over and over again, and he won't learn from it.
Yeah, so in a lot of ways... Like my original thought was, like he should have been able to make mincemeat of them. But then I kind of thought about the larger context of Anakin, even though all that context wasn't written at the time this book was written. I'm just thinking it does make sense for his character. It would actually make sense for his character to do that, you know.
Which is, again, a way we can dunk on Disney again, is that it sort of makes sense. In this context, for Leia to do as well as she did.
Right.
Although, even though we're saying that she survived, at least in the comic, it came across in depictions of like her facial expression and stuff that she was like just hanging on.
Oh, no, she was, even in the book.
She was just barely surviving.
Yeah.
And she only got one small nick on Darth Vader. Darth Vader didn't really look like he was in trouble at any time during his duel with Leia. Unlike the duel between Rey and Kylo Ren.
Right, right.
Where it was like, Rey could kill him right here, maybe.
Yeah, all of a sudden, like a seasoned veteran who's probably handled lightsabers for his entire life is bested by someone who's never held one before. So.
And Leia was like very explicitly just buying time for Luke to get out from some rubble he was trapped under. Which always happens in video games when you when you remove the crystal, everything starts to crumble down.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like kind of what ends up happening is Hala is able to lift using the Kyber crystal in the Force, because the Kyber crystal enhanced her Force ability. She lifts the, Hin lifts the stone off of Luke, and then Luke
is big old Yuzum that they saved.
Yeah. And then
he's such a good boy.
He cuts off Vader's arm and Vader runs away, retreats. Right. And then that's basically the end of the book.
Vader had a flashback to Mustafar.
Yeah.
He couldn't find it.
Funnily enough, like Luke in that fight, like references Obi-Wan Kenobi too. So he's probably having like PTSD.
He's like, I did say in our Darth Vader episode that he's a prime candidate to have PTSD. Yeah. He is exactly the kind of person.
Yeah, he's having flashbacks of like Obi-Wan cutting off every one of his limbs.
And he's fresh out of Sith drugs to make it all go away.
Yeah. But anyways, it was sort of interesting. What were your sort of thoughts on the story as a whole?
Yeah, for the graphic novel, I'll probably say this again and again as we talk about more graphic novels. I recommend it. Go read it if you had fun listening to this podcast. It's a fun Saturday morning cartoon in the Star Wars universe. Totally. And it's worth your time. There's some really good panels. I think especially reading comic books on iPads or e-readers, I find is like a better experience almost than reading them.
I'll actually almost second that. I did do a little bit of, for a while, I was doing all my comic book reading on my computer. But it is actually a great, when you can like zoom up the panels.
That's what I was going to say, because you can blow up every panel to full screen size.
Right. It's actually better. It's better than like the actual holding the book in a lot of ways, you know. So
scenes like, because at least in the Dark Horse app, not every single panel is blown up to full screen page.
Okay.
But it's just like particular panels that are important or took up a certain amount of page space are blown up to full size. And those three frames in particular that I mentioned of Luke slapping Leia in the face and her horrified expression. And then later on, Leia running away from the Wandrella with its big Sarlacc-like mouth trying to eat her, is like, those all really came out really well in the app and almost made it worth the price of admission for me. I just loved seeing those very evocative scenes. And also a personal connection with me, because I've been involved with the sport of axe throwing, is Princess Leia does a damn fine job of throwing an axe for the as far as we know, the first
she was like crazy,
the first and only, and I can tell you because I've coached hundreds, maybe thousands of people how to throw axes. And most people, it is not intuitive. You will not properly throw an axe the first time you try.
Yeah.
And she does it on a moving target with a stone axe.
I forgot about that scene,
Which has got to be tough. So big props to Leia for not only dummying that dude with your stone axe, but holding your own against Vader for a few ripostes.
Yeah, my overall impression of the book, it was a good book. It was like, it was fun. It wasn't too long. It was like a fairly easy read. So
I don't think it would have made a very good sequel to A New Hope at all.
No.
I think it would have been crap if they actually made that as a movie.
Totally. I agree. But it was sort of like a fun little side quest. And I think as long as that's what it is like a fun little side quest, then it's decent. But also, you know, I think I had a few little gripes with some of the way the book was written, but I do think Alan Dean Foster really stayed true to all of the characters that were in the book. Like, they did really feel like the same characters that I knew from the movies. And there wasn't a lot of deviation, even like R2-D2 and C-3PO. And you got to remember, this isn't in the backdrop of he has a whole trilogy of like established movies and characters.
Yeah, this is, as far as I can tell, this is just like a lunch meeting with George Lucas.
The only movie that had been released was Episode 4. And obviously, like, his meetings with George Lucas, and based on what George Lucas said, and he was like, he stayed very true to the characters and who they were and sort of what motivated them and all that, and their sort of attitudes. Even Leia, like you said, like having that sort of, she can kind of kick butt a little bit, you know.
I was gonna say that, like, Leia the action hero, really, but also Leia like the vulnerable person in some senses, another one of those panels that stuck with me was when Luke and Leia are fighting it out with a couple of stormtroopers.
Yeah.
And they're doing hand-to-hand combat, right?
Yeah.
Is Leia gets in what in a jiu-jitsu is called, like, she's got her hooks in, right? She's got a guy's back. She's in a great position if you're a seasoned jiu-jitsu fighter and you know what you're doing. She's in a great position to choke this guy out because she's on top of his back.
Yeah.
She's got her legs around his hips. She can hook those into his legs and block him from moving around and control him. But then in the comic depiction, I wish I could remember the people who drew the comics, because I thought they actually did a lot of good stuff with Leia's facial expressions in the comic book. But anyway, she looks like very scared when she's in this, what should be, and she was trained in martial arts and stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, she should know that this is a great position to be in, but like, you still see that vulnerability in her face and like, she's not sure of herself. She's a 19-year-old girl, for Christ's sake. Like,
yeah, well, also, even,
and she's fighting trained killers.
Another aside too on Leia's character was, there was like a brief mention about her time on the Death Star. They reference A New Hope, episode 4. And she's sort of like, she doesn't want to talk about what her experiences were on the Death Star, being tortured by the Imperials and by Darth Vader, because it was like so traumatizing, right? And it was sort of kind of an interesting character development thing.
Yeah, that's a great like moment to capitalize on.
Totally.
So good job, Alan Dean Foster. It's like, because that's certainly not something that comes across in the films, that
any
of these horrifically traumatic experiences have any impact on their life at all.
Yeah.
You don't see that in any of the movies, really.
Yeah totally. Yeah, so it really like sort of layered her character and but it was also like consistent, but added some cool things to it. So overall, it was like, yeah, it was a good book. I wouldn't say it was like an amazing book or... Yeah, you know, it's not going to blow you out of the water or anything, but...
If you're listening to this show, though, and you've listened this far into the episode, you should definitely read it.
Yeah,
I think read the graphic novel or the novel, depending on how much time you have on your hands.
Yeah, if you want. I think that a graphic novel does just as much justice as the book. so, yeah, I would recommend reading it, personally.
All right. Anything else to say about Splinter of the Mind's Eye?
No, I think that's it.
Actually, I had one question.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember why it was called Splinter of the Mind's Eye? Because I don't.
Yeah, because the Hala originally had a splinter of the Kyber crystal. And there was one line in the book. Sorry. There's one line in the book that I can't remember exactly how they worded it, but it was the Kyber crystal, you know, because it sort of focused your force energy. It was like your mind's eye energy or something to that effect.
That sort of makes sense.
Yeah, so this she had the splinter of the mind's eye, you
know.
Perfect. Yeah, so that was sort of the
All right. Well, we're dropping into orbit around Mimban, the traditional space.
Sarcopterus or whatever.
Circopause 5. I'm not sure what it's called now. Anyway, the traditional lands of the Mimbanese, the Thrella.
We recognize this Imperial Treaty land.
We recognize this Imperial. And the Kaway. All right. May the Force be with you.
Thanks for flying with us. We are interested to hear from you. You can reach us at starlorespodcast@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts, comments, or corrections. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating, review, and subscribe. You can also help us out through our Patreon at the Star Lores Podcast. Find us on Instagram, The Star Lords Podcast, on Facebook at The Star Lords Podcast, on Twitter at The Star Lords Podcast, and on YouTube, Star Lords Podcast. We'll catch you next time.